I am proud to announce that today's presentation marks the Watershed Academy's 25th webcast since its culmination in June of 2005. Reaching participants in all 50 states, D.C., Puerto Rico, and 5 foreign countries, I am happy to share with you that our monthly webcasts have reached over 7,000 participants. And now, on with the show. Coastal wetlands play an integral role in the health of our nation's waters and our nation's fisheries. In addition, they buffer coastal communities against the impacts of storms and sea level rise due to global climate change. Coastal managers and others interested in protecting wetlands can learn from this webcast presentation, which will highlight 2 national estuary programs impacted by significant wetlands losses. Carrie St. Pei, director of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, and Mark Carullo of the Massachusetts Bay's National Estuary Program will discuss methods for assessing the condition of wetlands, measuring wetlands loss, and techniques for restoring coastal wetlands. This webcast will also examine EPA's wetlands monitoring and assessment efforts at a national scale, including a discussion of the National Wetlands Condition Assessment. So, let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker is Carrie St. Pei. Carrie St. Pei has been, for the past 10 years, the Executive Director of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, an effort dedicated to preserving and restoring the 4.2 million acre area between the Mississippi and Atchafalaya Rivers in southeast Louisiana. He worked for 23 years as a field biologist and regional coordinator for the Louisiana Departments of Wildlife and Fisheries and Environmental Quality. His wetlands restoration work has been featured in the best-selling book Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast by Mike Tidwell, and most recently in the PBS documentary Washing Away, Losing Louisiana. Our second speaker is Michael Scazzafava. Michael has been with EPA since 2004 and in the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds since May 2006. He is chair of the National Wetlands Monitoring and Assessment Work Group, and co-lead on the 2011 National Wetland Condition Assessment. Michael earned an MS in Energy and Environmental Policy from the University of Delaware in 2004 with a focus on watershed management and is a former Presidential Management Fellow. There has been a slight change to our webcast speakers. Mark Carullo will be speaking in place of Jan Smith. Mark is a Geographic Information System, GIS, and Habitat Specialist with the Massachusetts Office of Coastal Zone Management, which was established to balance the impacts of human activity with the protection of coastal and marine resources. Mark develops tools and information for use in a variety of coastal management applications. He and his colleagues are currently developing a rapid assessment method for assessing the condition of estuarian wetlands in New England. So, now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Daryl Brown, Chief of U.S. EPA's Coastal Management Branch, would like to share a few words to kick off this webcast. Daryl?
Thank you, Megan. I'm Chief of the Coastal Management Branch, and here at EPA, we're the folks that oversee the National Estuary Program by providing management guidance and technical and financial assistance. So what is the NEP? For those of you who don't know, it's a community-based program designed to restore and maintain the water quality and ecological integrity of our nation's significant estuaries. It operates through partnership and consensus, where each NEP implements a management plan that has specific actions to improve water quality, habitat, and living resources. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the National Estuary Program, and one of the biggest achievements in this arena is in the area of habitat protection and restoration. Since 2000 alone, the National Estuary Programs around the country have protected and restored over 1 million acres of habitat, and over 400,000 of these acres have been wetlands. There are 28 National Estuary Programs across the country, each with a director and staff. And as you heard from Megan, we're fortunate to have 2 representatives from 2 of these NEPs with us today to talk about wetlands restoration and assessment, Carrie St. Pei and Mark Carullo. So with that introduction, I would now like to turn this over to Carrie for his presentation.
Okay, thanks a lot, Daryl. Well, welcome everyone to the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary in the deep delta country of the Mississippi River. I have to admit this is a little different for me. I mean, I usually like to interact with the crowd, but this is an excellent way for us to be able to reach a lot of people. So let's start with slide two, my first slide. My title is Resurrection of the Bayou People, 2007 AD, Wetlands, Hurricanes, and Restoration in the Deep Delta Region of the Mississippi River. And the title will become more obvious, or the reason for it will become more obvious as we proceed. And now let's start off with number three. I hope to be able to give everyone a glimpse into our region, not only the ecology of our region, but into the very soul of our people, which we've always believed here is linked to the ecology. The ecology and our culture is very much linked, and I think that's probably true within all of the national estuaries. We often struggle with explaining our differences to the rest of the country. There was a book written by Hornet Kane in 1944 entitled Deep Delta Country. And in the opening paragraph of his introduction, I think he really captured the essence of our region. And he talks about the Mississippi River pouring out of the heart of North America. And at the end, there's a different land. Of course, this land is the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary. And he talks about that it actually has an almost terrifying aspect.
So,
because of its differences. And that an observer would observe more closely and accurately to discover here a rare and untamed quality. That's pretty much the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary.
Shelly.
Okay, the next slide, number four. Is the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary from the air? Of course, the Barataria side is off towards the east of the slide here. Towards the right, the area between the Mississippi River and Bayou Lafourche. Bayou Lafourche is the feature that you see, the higher land that begins in the upper left part of the slide and courses down all the way towards the Gulf. Between the Bayou Lafourche there and the Mississippi River is the Barataria side, and everything on the left side of your slide between Bayou Lafourche and the Atchafalaya River is the Terrebonne side, so hence the name Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary. This is a 4.2 million acre area. The habitats you see or depicted in this slide range from open water near the Gulf of Mexico towards the south. And you'll see in here a number of features, almost fingers extending down towards the Gulf. These are the old remnant distributaries and the natural ridges associated with the Mississippi River as it laid down the wetlands that are essentially the webs between these fingers that jut down towards the Gulf. We, our communities here, are along these natural ridges. This is our high land. This is one of the things that makes us different from the ecology of the rest of the country. We are in a deltaic region. And so, therefore, we're very different, and our high land is actually towards the water and towards the streams rather than, away from the rivers, as in most of the rest of the country. Moving on to slide number five. This represents the various deltaic periods of the Mississippi River over a period of about 8,000 years, the Mississippi River has changed course, much like the end of a hose. It's moved from a channel into a more a less resistant channel towards the Gulf. Each time it did this, of course, during the spring floods, it would deposit new land and actually deposit new sediments over land that has been sinking. For 10,000 years, this whole region has been sinking, has been subsiding. It's just a part of our natural deltaic process. These are relatively recent lands, and so they compact. And as they compact, they sink. Each year, as the river floods, there's new layers of sediment that are laid down over these sinking marshes. Okay, the next slide. Slide number 6. One thing that we can all point to here in South Louisiana, many of us, this is a region that where the people who have settled here have stayed for generations. And therefore our culture has remained relatively intact for multiple generations. This is why it's another thing that makes us different. We are still a population that lives largely off what our wetlands produce. In my own particular case, my own family history, my ancestors settled here in 1760. And it's kind of unusual to realize that this was over 40 years before this place became the United States. And this is where he settled. The arrow points to the region of which is now called Barataria, Louisiana. And in the next slide, slide number 7, you get an indication of what this place looked like 40 years after my ancestors settled here. The point being that there's been many, many changes, and you can see from this very rare map that was produced by Lafon in 1806 that our landscape here in the Barataria-Terrebonne region looked quite different. It was continuous wetlands all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And the next slide, slide number 8, shows the relative location of that plantation when it was settled here in 1760. There were no levees, or very few levees, and the levees that were here, of course, were very small. There was a lot of protection. We had wetlands to protect us. There was really no need for levees in that time period. Next slide, number 9, begins to show you the changes that have occurred over time. Our system, as we have lost our wetlands, has become more Gulf dominant. In the Gulf, the salt waters of the Gulf of Mexico have intruded farther inland. And so now, in present day Barataria-Terrebonne, we have these bands of salt marsh. And slide 10, a little bit further to the north, you see our band of brackish marshes. And then in slide 11, the intermediate marshes. And a little further north, our fresh marsh types. And then even further north in the more stable soils, you'll see our cypress swamps. We have extensive cypress swamps in this region. And a lot of these surround our communities and afford probably the maximum level of protection as far as storm surge mitigation. And then in that final series, slide number 14, you'll see the ridges. These are the places where we live here. Our communities here are very linear because they follow these natural ridges along these old historic distributaries of the Mississippi River. We call these ridges here chenilles, which is French for place of oaks. These are very interesting habitats, and aside from providing protection from storm surges, they certainly are of vital importance as far as habitat. And on Grand Isle, which is one of our only, populated Barry Island, we still have remnants of the old oak forests on that island. as indicated earlier, I think Daryl mentioned that there are 28 national estuary programs. We are one of those 28, of course, and our program was nominated in 1989, as indicated in slide 15. Each of the national estuary programs begin with a fairly rigorous nomination process. And in that nomination process, we identify the priority issues that affect the region. In our case, in 1989, we identified seven priority issues that affect this region. The seven are listed, but you can generally lump them into three categories: the wetland loss issues, the water quality issues, and the wildlife issues. I'm only going to have time to talk about the wetland loss issues, which is the three priority problems indicated here: hydrologic modification, reduced sediment inflow, and habitat loss or modification. But I did want to make sure everybody fully understands that our National Estuary Program, as well as all of them, are very holistic in their approach, and the water quality issues and the wildlife issues are of equal importance. I just won't have time to go into them in great detail. So in slide 16, the first priority problem that I can talk about is hydrologic modification. And of course, what we're speaking of here is that we have changed the way that water naturally moves throughout our system. And in South Louisiana, the main way that we have done that is to dig access canals for oil and gas exploration. Now, a lot of that was done in the early 50s or mid-50s, and at a time when wetlands were generally considered to be wastelands and places that we could afford to lose an acre here, a couple of hundred acres there, and there would really be no impacts from that. That was the thinking back then. But at the same time, we certainly did move by 1972 with the passage of the Clean Water Act into a time period where we did understand the impacts of changing hydrology in our wetlands. But we did it anyway. We still dug canals and fairly indiscriminately. And then there's navigation canals, as depicted on the right side of the slide, such as the Intracoastal Waterway and many other navigation streams that we have cut through our wetland system. The point being here that these all provide conduits for the storm surges, the big walls of water that are pushed in from the Gulf of Mexico in advance of our hurricanes. And these conduits provide, these canals provide unrestricted routes for these highly saline waters to move far up into the freshwater systems where the plants are killed. And once the plants are killed, there's the root systems, of course, decompose, and there's nothing to hold these very rich and organic sediments together. And so we result in a land loss issue. In slide 17, second priority problem that I can cover is reduction in sediment availability. Largely what we're speaking of here is we have fooled around with the Mississippi River, and we have levied the Mississippi River, and we've interrupted the very process that kept us in the net building of land. I mentioned earlier that this place has been sinking and subsiding for 10,000 years, but the annual additional sediments that were deposited offset that subsidence. Well, we've levied off the river, and we did that largely following the tragedies, the tragic floods of 1927, which are depicted in the black and white photos here, with people living on levees for months. It was a national tragedy and created tremendous flooding throughout the Mississippi watershed. And people often blame the Corps of Engineers for building the levees, but we'd like to point out that, of course, it was the people that demanded that these levees be built and to confine the Mississippi River to its current channel. That was successful. They did confine the Mississippi River to its current channel, and so consequently all the sediments that are coming down the river currently flow off the end of the continental shelf. It's about 100 million metric tons that flow off the end of the continental shelf annually from the Mississippi River. Mississippi River watershed is huge, and in slide 18, this is a very unusual shot of the Mississippi River from our standpoint. This is at its beginning at Lake Itasca. The next slide, 19, shows you the river as we know it. It's quite different. There's a lot of things that happen between Lake Itasca and the head of passes, which is depicted here in slide number 19. Mississippi River was and is the mother of the Baratari-Terrebonne National Estuary. Just as a matter of perspective, the boat that you see in the picture here is an ocean-going vessel. It's a ship. This is a quite large part of the river. It's about a mile across down in this region. In slide 20, what I'm showing here is, you know, we have a lot of people around the country that believe that the reason we are not rebuilding our marshes with the Mississippi River is because of the reduced sediment load in the river. Others believe that it's because we built levees. But let's examine the Mississippi River and the sediment load currently in that river. And the science tells us that since 1850, the suspended sediment load in the Mississippi River has declined by 80%. And so even if we didn't have the levees that we have now, the sediment load flowing down the Mississippi River would probably not be sufficient to offset this subsidence that we have, and would not be enough to sustain the marshes that we have. And remember, our uses have changed over time. It's no longer a fresh system as it was at the time my ancestors settled here. I already showed you that we have these bands of salt marsh, brackish marsh, and fresh marsh. Our uses are dictated by those habitat types. And so we have extensive brown shrimp fishery, oyster fishery, and other fisheries that depend on some salinities. And this becomes very, very important when you move forward to our current time and begin discussing restoration. What can we do to restore it? And I will cover that a little later. In slide 21, the third priority problem, which is absolutely because of the first two that I already discussed, is the habitat loss that the Baratari-Terrebonne system is currently experiencing. We are, the Baratari-Terrebonne system, is the fastest disappearing landmass on Earth. Most of our national estuary programs all deal with habitat loss and wetland loss issues. Most of that, maybe not all, but most is due to development, you know, where we would take an area of wetlands and, you know, it's subject to being filled or otherwise developed. That's a very, very small part of our problem. Our problem is that our wetlands are turning into open water. And it's because of the issues that I previously discussed. The whole system is sinking, the whole platform. The land masses that we live on, the ridges, as well as the wetlands, everything is sinking. And we are not offsetting that sinking. We're not building land because of what we've done to the Mississippi River, both here locally with the levees and also within throughout the whole watershed. For years, we spent our time in the early parts of our program trying to convince our elected officials that restoration was something that we needed to focus on. We didn't really gain traction until the problem became so great that our communities are now absolutely completely vulnerable from storm surges. Remember, I mentioned we lived in these linear communities. We have the streams that we live in next to, but usually there's a levee towards what we call the back, or perpendicular away from the natural levee. There are man-made levees that protect us on what we call the marsh side, protect us from storm surges. Those levees have had to become progressively higher because of the increased threat and our increased susceptibility from storm surges. Hurricanes used to be our only issue. Now, because of our wetland loss issue, just extended periods, a couple of days of southerly winds are now flooding our roads because there's no marshes to keep that water from piling up against these back levees. Slide 22. I'm going to go through a series of slides here. This is the system as it appeared in 1839. Of course, the green being wetlands, lighter colors, the lighter blue is open water. In slide 23, we move to 1870. And you can see that there's been more light colored open water. In the next slide, slide 24, in 1993, there's more. And you can see that our wetland loss issue is not shoreline erosion, it's internal marshes that are breaking up and turning into open water. And then in slide 25, we jump all the way to 2020, which is predicted. Of course, this was all pre-Katrina. We had no way of predicting the results of future hurricanes, but this is what we were predicting. This was done about in 1995, these predictions. Slide 26 depicts our oil and gas industry. We do produce oil and gas here. About 25% of the nation's domestic oil and gas supply comes from the Barataria-Terrebonne system, actually. And a lot of this, there's a lot of offshore production, and the spaghetti that you see south of Louisiana, the Gulf of Mexico, or offshore oil transport lines. These all come from offshore facilities, and they come in towards and on inshore to the storage facilities. And these splotches of black that you see are actually collections of individual oil wells. You may be asking, what does this have to do with wetland loss? Well, slide 27, I try to illustrate this. A lot of those pipelines that come inshore or follow open water routes, and in open water routes they are buried deep beneath the bottom of the open water system. But at some point they have to cross wetlands, and you'll see that I've drawn in the former location of the shoreline here, and from that point towards the upper left of your slide indicates where an existing oil transport line was buried beneath the marsh. And of course, as you remove that marsh, that pipeline has become exposed. And so we are having frequent oil spills, many of which are as a result of boats hitting these pipelines that were once buried under marshes and are now very shallow in open water and subject to damage from boats. Slide 28, I depict what our current program looks like. The implementation phase of our structure encompasses our management conference, which is the group of people that we work with that guide our program. It also incorporates our program office staff, our nonprofit foundation that's attached to our program, as well as the public, and we involve the public in a process that we call action plan teams. Slide 29 gives you just a quick view. I don't expect anybody to read all these names, but if you would peruse through those names, you would see that there are a lot of groups, a lot of people, a lot of organizations that comprise our management conference. We still are very active with this management conference. We meet quarterly. These are the folks that guide our program. Slide 30, I want to spend a little time on a conceptual model for our approach, and I would guess is the approach of all national estuary programs. We're talking about very complex issues, and it can overwhelm our people. These three triangles depict the way that the government largely deals with these complex issues. You know, we have the federal and state agencies and local agencies and groups that deal with the natural factor, you know, the ecology, the water quality, land masses, the biological communities themselves. Those all exist. And if they exist during the existence of our program, and they existed before. We have the management factor, and, you know, the agencies that create regulations and hopefully enforce those regulations and compile databases. Then we have the human factor. That's essential. You know, how do you involve the public? How do you get national recognition? This is all an educational process. And what about the economic development? These are all important concepts when you are talking about restoring a system. And in the next slide, I try to depict how our National Estuary Program, and I would wager, as I've said, all National Estuary Programs interact with this complexity. We, the program office, are the linking factors. Our goal, our objective, our mission is to link all of these various groups that are focused on some aspect of restoration. That's our mission. That's what we do. Slide 32, spend a little time here. I'm not going to be able to spend a whole lot of time on this, but all National Estuary Programs create comprehensive conservation and management plans over the time of our planning period. At the time that we started, we had 5 years. Our plan is created in this technical supplement. We have 51 actions, and they go well beyond just the habitat and the living resources and water quality. They actually include education components and the preservation of our cultural heritage and even economic development. Slide 33 just introduces the next slide, 34. Everyone wants to hear about Katrina, every presentation I give nowadays. Of course, I have to talk about Katrina. And that's very understandable, because Katrina was a tremendous impact to our region. In August of 2005, Katrina passed over Lower Plaquemines Parish, almost directly over my hometown, Fort Sulphur, Louisiana. And I realized that most of the nation is well aware of the impacts of New Orleans, but may not be so aware of the impacts to the rest of the region. The counterclockwise path or motion of these hurricanes, in this case, pushed a storm surge of about 29 feet from the east side of the Mississippi River, crossed the east levee, crossed the Mississippi River, and completely washed over the southern half of Plaquemines Parish with a devastating force, and actually breached the, what I mentioned earlier, the back or the marsh side protection levee. And it continued northward, as indicated in slide 35, and continued to pump water into the St. Bernard Parish region and continued to pump water into the Lake Pontchartrain system and, of course, eventually flooded New Orleans and proceeded to devastate the Mississippi Gulf Coast. It also, because of that counterclockwise motion, pushed a new storm surge through the breaches in the back levee, on the Marshside levee, in Plaquemines Parish. Slide 36, I show you the condition of, actually, the subdivision I grew up in Port South Louisiana, before Hurricane Katrina. And in the lower part of that slide is the Mississippi River. Just north of that, or just above that, is the Mississippi River levee. And you see an indication of the very linear way that we settle our communities, because you can see that back Marshside levee and then just vast wetlands on the other side of that protection system. So you should be able to understand very easily, just looking at this photo, how much we depend on those wetlands to protect us. And imagine, just broad expanses of wetlands at the time of, 1760, when my own ancestor first settled the region. It was just broad expanses. And there are ridges out there which you can't really see in this photo. In the next photo is that same subdivision about a month after Katrina. Actually, about 2 weeks after Katrina. You can't see it. I can't use a laser pointer here. But if you would look all the way to the left, to the right side of this photo, is the location now of the house I grew up in, and it was pushed a quarter of a mile away, and that, I just use that to indicate the condition of thousands and thousands of people. We were very lucky because we, of course, didn't live in that house, still owned it, but we were very lucky in that most people lived in those houses, and the current condition of these regions is still very much devastated. Slide 38 actually is a close-up of that house that I grew up in. The entire southern half of Plaquemines Parish looked pretty much just like this. Most of the structures in southern Plaquemines Parish are now in a dumpster or a landfill somewhere. St. Bernard Parish, the water came in with a little less velocity, but it flooded the whole parish. And, of course, in New Orleans, because of the levee breaks, there are thousands and thousands of houses that remained underwater for weeks. Slide 39 is a close-up of one of the natural features, the natural chenier ridges. These are the structures that provide most of the hurricane protection among our natural habitats. Hurricane Rita, 2005, skip all the way to 41, number 41. Hurricane Rita was a month later after Katrina and passed all the way to the, about 150 miles to the west of the Terrebonne side of our system. And in the next slide, 42, I depict a level of flooding in Terrebonne Parish from Hurricane Rita, which passed 150 miles all the way to the west of our system, caused a level of flooding that has been greater than anything in recorded history. Why such a massive amount of flooding from a hurricane so far away? It's absolutely because, and directly because, of wetland loss. They're more susceptible. Slide 43 shows the marsh loss that we suffered from Katrina and Rita alone, 217 square miles of wetland loss solely from those two hurricanes. This was an incredible loss. No one expected this degree of wetland loss. This is definitely a very spike, a huge spike in our wetland loss rate. Slide 44, I want to get into how do we fix this. amongst all these complexities. Slide 45 indicates what we were considering in the early parts of our program. We feel that we need to turn to the Mississippi River. The Barrett-Jack Terrebonne program is fully of the belief that we need to use Mississippi River water to as a protective strategy to at least sustain what we have left. During our planning process, there were those that suggested that we needed huge water volumes to rebuild land. And we discussed that at great length. It was fully debated. But because of the reduced sediment load in the Mississippi River and the uses that we now have in the system, it was decided that huge volumes of water in the system would eradicate our current way of life, and that and there was little return as far as land building because of that reduced sediment load in the river. And the sense of urgency is too great, and we have to look at strategies that are quicker than the geologic time periods it would take for the Mississippi River to rebuild us. So in slide 46, we have been a huge advocate of promoting the only land building strategy that we know of that is consistent with our CCNP, and that is that we need to harvest the sediment from where it is, which is in the bottom. It's in the bottom of the Mississippi River. It's in the bottom of the Atchafalaya. And we need to harvest that with dredges, and use pump pipelines that we would construct and pass these pipelines over open water routes and to rebuild the systems that we've lost with these enriched sediment diversions. Slide 47, give you an idea of what's possible. We know that the Corps of Engineers, New Orleans District, alone dredges about 22 million cubic yards of sediment from the Mississippi River from a navigation channel only. And all of that sediment, well, the overwhelming majority, is brought offshore and dumped off the continental shelf. In the Atchafalaya, equally, there's tremendous resources there. In the last 10 years, we've had 178 million cubic yards that have been dredged from the navigation channel. And I want to point out that this is only from the navigation channel. This does not include the substantial quantities of sediments that are in the depositional areas along the shoreline of the Mississippi River and the Atchafalaya. Slide 48 shows the many projects where we've harvested sediment and used those sediments in other for other reasons, including building highway roadbeds, golf courses, and such. There's no question that this is completely doable. In fact, in slide 49, I indicate one of the very recent projects that we've done where we rebuilt a Barrier Island from offshore sediment deposits at Timbaleer Island. Slide 50 shows you the location of a ridge and marsh system that we have built as a program with many of our partners. And in slide 51, I show the ridge part of that system. We've built a total of 800 acres of ridge and wetlands, marshes associated with that, in a period of about 2 years. Much of this was financed by one of our partners, the Greater Lafourche Port Commission, but a lot of this was financed by our own funding, our own Section 320 funding, and grants from other sources. Slide 52, there's just no question that this is a very doable strategy and meets our CCNP and meets that level of agreement that that must be followed if we're going to succeed. Everyone has ideas, and we're still throwing out new ideas. Even after our plan was agreed upon in 1996, there have been several new planning efforts. And it seems that the human species has an overwhelming desire to plant, and we keep planting, and we keep replanting. It's time for us to stop the planting and follow the plans and start implementing something. Slide 53, this whole pipeline sediment strategy that we are promoting has been evaluated. These show you in slide 53 the polygons and shapes that could be rebuilt. This represents 400 square miles of wetlands that could be rebuilt according to the evaluation in 50 years. Slide 54 gives you an idea of the costs involved with this, and we show three alternatives here. Alternative three is the one we prefer because it's the most aggressive, and using that strategy, we could rebuild 116,000 acres in 50 years, and yes, it is expensive. It would cost $634 million per year. And I like to point out that, yes, it is expensive, but once you decide that this region is worthy of restoration, then you have to look for the cheapest way to do that. And assuming that we're talking about a need for sediments, this obviously is the cheapest way to get the sediments to the locations we need. Slide 55, we show a very recent new planning effort from our state. The state legislature has ordered state agencies to develop a master plan. This is the master plan in the Barataria side. We were involved with this. In fact, the polygons, the shapes that indicate marsh creation are largely there because of our influence. Slide 56 is just another part of the plan. This involves the Corps of Engineers plan. In the same way that the state agency in Louisiana was ordered to come up with a plan, Congress ordered the Corps of Engineers to come up with a restoration plan, which involved coastal restoration as well as levee alignments, which are indicated in slide 57 under the Corps plan. This has been a very in-depth discussion on levee alignments. Levees and wetlands don't always mix, and so there's been a lot of effort trying to discuss where do we put levees without adversely impacting levees. Slide 58 shows you the Terrebonne side and the state plan part of it. And again shows some levee alignments as well as some of the polygons of marsh creation. Slide 59 is the levee alignment portion of the Corps of Engineers plan. I'm just trying to depict here that there's been a lot of discussion on where do we put these levees. This still has not been decided. The Corps plan is due in December. We have no idea how much of this will actually get funded, if any of it. Slide 60 is just another levee alignment. Just really don't have time to go into it in great detail. Again, just trying to depict that there's a lot of discussion on where do we put these levees. And incidentally, the Corps plan also involves, of course, marsh restoration. And there's been a lot of modeling done that indicates very strong benefits from various marsh types on mitigating storm surges. Nearing the end here, slide 61. Following Katrina, we of course received a lot of inquiries as to whether or not we were still above water or what, and one of the folks that contacted us was someone that I had met on a panel at Tulane, a lady named Aurora Levins Morales, and she was a poet. And she sent me a poem that was entitled Resurrection. And she had written this poem many months, maybe years before Katrina. But it was involving a plant that we have here in the South called resurrection fern, which for you biologists out there is an epiphyte, usually living in the in oak trees, live oak trees, on the top of the branches. And it's called resurrection fern because it's usually a collection of dried up twigs, looks pretty dead. And then in slide 62 is the first couple stanzas of that poem. And she talks about when the rains come and resurrection fern springs up in a green mass of strong backs. Move to slide 63. And the arch fronds making leaf out of water, and the reservoirs of hope hidden in their wiry roots. I've used this poem, go to slide 64, to illustrate that, I really think that this poem really depicts exactly what our people are going through. And I have a series of slides, which are usually in an animation, which isn't really amenable to a webcast. But move to slide 65. Last part of this stanza, slide 66. If you listen, you can hear them singing the gospel of life's stubborn return. That's exactly what our people are going through right now. We do have a resilient population. Multitudes of cultures have settled here. All of them are very wiry types of people, have been subjected to hurricanes numerous times over our history, and yet we've endured. Our culture remains. Our habitat is hanging on. It's very sick. But in order for us to continue this culture, we're going to have to restore our wetlands. You know, the very thing that that causes us to be who we are as a people. And slide 67, again, is back with Resurrection Fern next to Aurora's poem. And slide 68 is the end. And thank you all for your attention. I hope everybody could hear me. I was getting messages that couldn't hear real good, so I was trying to speak up. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Kerry. We will pause briefly here to take some questions. If everyone could please move with me to slide number 69. Okay, we're going to begin with those questions that were submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. And our first question comes from Jean in Media PA. Jean would like to know, will wetland restoration help to minimize the impacts of climate change?
Well, we certainly are well aware of the looming probability of global sea level rise. We are the poster child for what happens when sea level rises, and not because necessarily the sea has been rising, but because we've been sinking. So the effect to us is the same. One thing we know we're going to need is elevation. We believe that this pipeline sediment transport strategy that we're talking about gives us a way to keep up with the elevation. So, I mean, we are hopeful that if global sea level rise is slow enough that we can maintain the health of our wetland system using freshwater input and possibly augmenting with sediments to keep our wetlands healthy enough that we can produce enough of the vegetative components to keep up with that slow, hopefully, sea level rise.
And our next question also comes from Gene in Media PA. Are considerations being given to let the wetlands restore themselves and let the coastal populations relocate to higher areas?
That's been something that's been discussed repeatedly. First of all, the wetlands will not repair themselves. It's too far gone. Even if we blew up the Mississippi River levees, there's not enough sediment coming down the river. That we just don't even see that as a viable option. We do hear people talk about relocation, and that's a possibility. But even to, at this point in our history, it's largely, almost universally accepted that it is far cheaper to restore the place than it is to move, you know, the communities. The oil and gas infrastructure, it's just not something that's being legitimately considered. The only option to us is restore the place.
Okay, at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Are there any questions over the phone?
Hi, this is Carrie from New Jersey.
Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Carrie. Not a question, just a thank you. It was a great presentation and very helpful. I particularly like the model that I think you've shown me in the past, showing how the estuary program coordinates and facilitates various partners to achieve some of the goals, not only in the CCMC, but you know, for broader society issues. So thank you. It was a great presentation.
Thank you, Karen.
Are there any other questions from the phones?
I have a question. This is Kira Smith from EPA in D.C. You talk about dredging the Mississippi River. Aren't you worried about the impacts to the areas where you're dredging? I mean, I don't know if there would be some flooding and some habitat destruction just from the dredging.
Well, the sediments in the Mississippi River are very, very fluid. They're moving constantly. And these are sediments that, you know, without the influence of humans, would largely be coursing over the river.
Hello?
All we're trying to do is harvest those sediments and use them beneficially. So,
thanks.
No, we think that these sediments would naturally be redeposited in our wetlands. And so we think we're moving towards towards a natural condition rather than away from it.
Are there any other questions from the fans?
This is Dan Platt. And I just had a question, not in sediments. It's a great presentation, but any hazards involved?
I'm totally unhappy about
That you guys have found as far as old
times? Yeah, like the first time I thought it was just an accident, you know.
Last part of your question was blocked out. Somebody else was talking. I couldn't hear it.
Oh, I'm sorry. As far as
Alpha
they're using saturation, any problems or mitigation things?
We are going to mute the phone system, and then, Carrie, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself again, okay?
Okay.
Okay, Carrie, unmute yourself, please.
Okay.
And if there's one speaker that... Did you hear the question, or we need the question?
I couldn't
question?
Hear. I heard part of it, but I couldn't hear all of it.
Okay. Whoever is the speaker that wants to ask a question again, please ask your question again. I'm going to open the phone lines.
Hi, this is Ann Platt again. I was asked a question before. What I was wondering was, as far as sediments were concerned, were there any issues with them as far as any environmental hazards, things of that sort? Or
was
it
enough to use? Maybe less than he was trying to tell Humphrey. Because
I almost heard all of the questions, but the most critical part, when you were saying as far as the blank is concerned.
Okay. So I've been now.
Just repeat that part.
I'm sorry.
Unless I'm in there.
We're just wondering, I mean, whether or not the sediments that you're using, is there any problem with contamination?
You're fine.
Okay. I got it now.
I haven't tried that one.
Carrie, could you please unmute yourself again? If you're not asking a question, we would really appreciate it if you could mute yourself so that we can hear the questions being asked and the answers from our speakers. Carrie, please unmute yourself to answer.
Okay, I'm back. Okay, yeah, I got the question that time, and it's a good question. We have reams of data on sediment contaminants in the Mississippi River. The short answer is no. We do not have concerns. There are no undue quantities and concentrations of contaminants in the sediments of the river that we are concerned about. I mean, there's still some derivatives of the old organic pesticides, chlorinated pesticides, DDT derivatives and such, but nothing that is of concern, and certainly nothing that is greater than the condition of the sediments that we have. I mean, we're looking at the old trace elements of those contaminants, but nothing of concern.
Thank you, Carrie. At this time, we will move on to our next session. So, Michael, take it away.
Thanks, Megan. If you guys could move to slide 70, you can see my very, very creative title to my presentation, Wetlands Monitoring Assessment. What I'm going to try and do for this session is just give a very brief overview of what we're doing with EPA's national program to promote state, tribal, and local governments' capacity to monitor and assess their wetlands. Touch a little bit on plans for a 2011 National Wetland Condition Assessment, some research we're doing in the Gulf of Mexico for that assessment, and then move on to some new work we're doing here in the national program to think about how we can use wetland assessment data to inform decision making, so prioritizing restoration plans and wetlands protection plans at a watershed scale, similar to the maps that Carrie was showing earlier. So moving on to slide 71, I just wanted to start off with this slide. Anybody who's been involved with wetlands assessment and EPA has seen this millions of times. EPA has developed a three-level approach for assessing wetland condition, and basically what you're seeing here is as you move from level 1 to level 3, the assessment approach becomes more rigorous. At level 1, we're talking about a desktop-type assessment where you're using GIS and aerial photography to make general statements on the condition of a wetland. At level 2, this is your rapid wetland assessment. This usually involves simple metrics. It'll take you about 1 to 2 hours in the field, depending on the size of your assessment area. Some people call it an organized best professional judgment. And Mark Carullo, who's going to be speaking next, is going to get into more details on a rapid assessment method for salt marshes that they're developing in Massachusetts. And level 3, this is your traditional water quality monitoring approach where you're setting transects, collecting samples, and then calculating your IBI or other assessment approach. The one important thing I want to point out here is the point of the three levels is to become confident in your level 1 and level 2 methods. These are your more rapid, less intensive methods, thereby minimizing your time in a field. The way you calibrate these methods is by the way you do that, become confident, is by calibrating your more rapid methods with the level 3 intensive site assessment data across a range of wetlands and ecotones. It's really important not to jump to the level 2 rapid assessment method without that calibration work. Some states have chosen to do this calibration as they go, so they develop a level 2 tool, and they go out and they collect level 3 data with the level 2 data. Others first collect that level 3 intensive data and then develop a rapid method from that. So moving on to slide 72, this is our schedule for the National Wetland Condition Assessment, which will field work will take place in 2011. This is one in a series of aquatic resource surveys. We just got finished with field work for the lake survey. We put out a weightable streams assessment report in 2006. And for wetlands, we'll be out in the field in 2011. We are heavily in the research phase, as you can see, and we hope to have that research done by 2010. The planning to date has been and will continue to be inclusive of state, tribal, and local folks, especially as we move, as we begin to discuss indicators and assessment methods, because we're not trying to recreate the wheel. We want to build off the good work that's going on in the states, such as what Mark's going to talk about after this. Moving on to slide 73, a little background on what we've done to date with the National Wetland Condition Assessment. We're collaborating with Fish and Wildlife Service on this. Fish and Wildlife Service has documented trends in wetlands acreage since the late 1970s. Their most recent status and trends report was put out in 2005 and found for the first time that wetland gains exceeded wetland losses. However, looking at the data, the EPA and other agencies involved in wetlands protection found that that increase was mostly due to an increase in open water ponds. Some of these ponds may provide limited wetland function. So we're thinking that by collaborating with the Fish and Wildlife Service and producing this National Condition Report, we'll have an exciting opportunity to produce a complementary report that reports the quality of those same status and trends wetlands that we have a known history of trends in wetlands acreage. So basically, we're going to be providing more detail on exactly what's going on, that quality piece to go with the quantity. Moving on to slide 74, this is the current distribution of status and trend plot locations. Each one of these red dots represents a 4-square-mile plot that Fish and Wildlife has been analyzing since the 1970s, the status and trends of wetlands acreage within these plots. It's a statistical survey. And before folks east of the west of the Mississippi send me some hate mail, I'll let you know that before we do the National Wetland Condition Assessment, we're going to be supplementing these plots and using them as our sampling frame. So, you know, the sampling frame, it determines which wetlands have a chance of being sampled in the statistical survey, and what we're using for our sampling frame is wetlands of interest coded polygons within these 4x4, these 4-square-mile plots. So let me get a little bit into some of the research we're doing, or you know, how we're going to operationalize a national survey using this sample frame. Right now, our ORD lab in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and I'm on slide 75, is leading a Gulf of Mexico coastal wetlands pilot survey. That's in partnership with the USGS National Wetlands Research Center in Lafayette, Louisiana. The primary objective of this survey is to evaluate design and indicator options for the national survey. So we're going to be testing this sampling frame option, and we're going to be testing a number of potential indicators across all three levels that I talked about earlier across a variety of wetlands. So the point is to research these design options. However, as a result of this research, we should be able to report at a very broad scale the ambient condition of Gulf of Mexico wetlands. So moving on to slide 76, this is just a kind of a blow-up of the same plot map I showed on slide 74. This is just the plots that you'll find in the Gulf of Mexico region. And you'll see that red line here indicates what the ORD is calling for this project, the Gulf of Mexico coastal boundary. Basically, it's defined as 8-digit HUCs that influence the coastal region. In some cases, that boundary includes 2 HUCs, so 8-digit watersheds. Moving on to slide 77, within those plots that I showed on the previous slide, they defined wetlands of interest within those plots to include 6 quartering categories of wetlands that you can see in the top left-hand part of the slide. Those are estuarine marsh, estuarine shrub scrub, clustering marsh, clustering forest, clustering shrub scrub, and clustering farmed wetlands. So the sampling frame for this project is the wetland of interest coded polygons, those that you see in the top left, within those S&T plots, which you saw on slide 76, found in that red Gulf of Mexico coastal boundary. Basically, they selected 100 random sites, and that was due mostly to budgetary constraints, and they stratified those plots to include a relatively even amount of each of the six cordon categories of wetlands, because, remember, this is the purpose of this is to test indicators across a variety of wetlands. Moving on to 78, you'll see a blow-up of a plot in Louisiana, and this just gives you an example of what you'll see in each one of those little red dots. I show it on the national map. So basically, a coded polygon of interest, like you see on the left-hand side, the orange polygon is a clustered forested polygon. That has a probability of being sampled. So we'll drop a point in there, and that becomes a sample site. And once you get to the sample site, what you do is you draw two circles around it. One, your purple, and I'm on slide 79. One, your purple circle there, that's your buffer, and that's where you'll use your landscape or your level one metrics to characterize the buffer, the surrounding land use. Within that orange circle, that's your in the field assessment area. In this case, it's a 50 meter assessment area where you take your level two and level three field measurements. One important thing to keep in mind is that this survey is measuring the area within this assessment unit, so just the area within that orange circle. And it's that assessment unit is supposed to be a representative sample of the population of wetlands across the Gulf Coast. This is important because this survey is not necessarily providing conclusions on any one particular wetland. We're talking about the population of wetlands. So then what do you do once you get to that site? You do your three-tiered assessment. So I've talked about so far how we're planning, designing, and implementing an ambient wetland condition assessment at national regional scales. However, what I want to go over in the next few slides, and I'm on slide 80, is to show you how this process, including designing the sample frame, selecting the sample sites, implementing the 1-2-3 approach, can be applied at the watershed scale as well to inform decision making. And this data can be used to inform wetland protection and restoration strategies, including prioritizing wetland protection at the watershed scale, developing watershed scale wetlands restoration plans, and generally incorporating wetland quality or wetland condition information into more holistic watershed planning. So on slide 81, let's give you an example from one state. So after you've completed your ambient condition assessment, your most basic analysis will give you something like you see here in this condition profile. Notice that the chart not only indicates the area of each HGM class of wetlands, but assigns each wetland within that class to a bin along the condition gradient. In this case, the red indicates wetlands of the lowest quality, and light green are the highest quality. And this is, of course, when we're talking about relative quality, that's departure from a reference condition that's been previously established. So then, once you have this information, you can use that to establish management categories on slide 82 for all the wetlands in that watershed. In this watershed, those management categories range from the red, which you can barely see on this map, which is protection only or holding the line, to those in the more intensive dark green color, which require intensive hydrology and species-based restoration. Again, the point here is to show you that you can use this assessment information at a watershed scale to prioritize your resources for protecting and restoring wetlands. And it also can feed nicely into an existing watershed plans by identifying critical areas for conservation and areas for leveraging existing resources, as you'll see in slide 83. So, that's all I have in terms of slides. Before I pause for questions, I want to recap on my major points. We have established this three-level approach for assessing wetland conditions, and many states and tribes have developed tools in all three levels that can be applied at the watershed scale. A survey designed similar to what we're doing with the National Port can also be applied at that watershed scale, and that information can then be used to inform management of wetlands resources in a watershed context. we're thinking. This is new territory for EPA's Wetlands Monitoring Assessment Program, which is why this presentation was short on the specific details on moving from an assessment to a management plan. We're working through the National Wetlands Monitoring and Assessment Work Group to produce a plan on how to exactly operationalize this idea, and we're welcoming any input and ideas. I think my email is available on the website, so please, if you have any ideas or any experience with this, please let me know. And with that, I'll pause for questions.
Thank you, Michael. We will now pause for a few questions, and if I could get everyone to move to slide 85. We're going to begin with those questions submitted online, and just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Jeremy in Virginia, and Jeremy asks, would EPA staff be conducting all work on the wetland survey, or would it be a combination of state, private, federal, et cetera, staff? Who would conduct QA, QC if many agencies were involved?
Excellent question, Jeremy. I should have gotten more into the details of what the background on these surveys is. EPA will be designing the survey, so producing the quality assurance project plan, the SOPs, the design, developing a standard protocol. However, the field work will be done by the states or tribes, depending on the number of sites that fall in under your jurisdiction. That work will be funded through a special monitoring initiative that's funded through Clean Water Act 106 grant. So this is how the previous surveys have been funded, and if you have questions about that, I encourage you to give me a call or email me.
Our second question comes from Karen in Oklahoma. Karen asks, what is HGM?
Excellent question. It's another wetlands classification system known as the hydrogeomorphic classification system. I believe the foundations of it, and I'm not an expert in this, are you're classifying wetlands based on both the landscape's position, so a depression or a slope wetland, and the water source. So a depressional wetland, its primary water source would basically precipitation or groundwater. A riverine wetland, this is, you know, adjacent to a stream, so its primary water source would be, you know, high water levels, that type of thing.
And Karen from Oklahoma would also like to know, what is the difference between estuarian and palustrine wetlands?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't have a good answer for that, I'm sorry. But I think it deals with position on the landscape as well.
And our next question comes from Brian in Alaska. And Brian asks, will Alaska be included in the National Wetland Condition Assessment? In particular, is the North Slope included, which is experiencing increasing wetlands impacts from oil and gas activities?
The national surveys to date have focused solely, they've dropped 1,000 points in the lower 48 states, and $8 million is allocated for that. Alaska, Hawaii, and the territories are given a special or a separate amount of money to do a watershed scale assessment or something like that at their choosing from that Clean Water Act 106 Monitoring Initiative Fund.
Okay, and at this time I'm going to open the phone line. So if you do have a question, again, please unmute yourself and give us your name and where you're from. If you don't have a question, please keep yourself muted so that we can hear the questions. Are there any questions? Any questions from the fence? Okay, if there are no further questions, if I could please get everyone to move to slide 86. Before we get on to our final section of today's presentation, I would like to take a moment to tell you about our next webcast. The Watershed Academy webcast team will sponsor its 26th free seminar on October 3rd, so just next week. This webcast, titled Water, Energy, and Climate Change, will feature Don Elder, President of River Network, and Susan Kaderka, the Director of the National Wildlife Federation. Most people now understand that we have a climate problem, but few yet appreciate how big it is or what it will take to solve it. This webcast will explore the dimensions of this global problem and frame the ensuing discussions about what water quality managers at the federal, state, and local level, along with the watershed protection community, can do to rise to the climate challenge. This webcast will explore major opportunities to save water and energy together, thereby reducing greenhouse gas emissions and limiting climate change. Watershed practitioners, utilities, community leaders, and agency officials can all benefit from hearing about the profound implications of climate change on our water resources and what we can all do now to protect our future. Again, this webcast will take place on October 3rd. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast to register for this webcast. At this time, Mark, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself and take it away.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Megan, and thanks to Watershed Academy for the opportunity to speak. Again, this is Mark Carullo. I am with the Massachusetts Office of Coastal Zone Management, and I'm going to talk to you today about our wetlands assessment program that we have been collaborating with on with the Massachusetts-based National Estuary Program. Jan Smith, director of the NEP program here in Massachusetts, could not speak with you today, but I'm going to try to do my best to fill in for him and work with his presentation. So, again, I will certainly be happy to fill in any gaps that I miss at the end of the session, a little Q&A. So first I'd like to set some background information up for you on the Wetlands Assessment Program. About 12 years ago, folks at Wetlands Protection in Massachusetts was really regulatory and focused on compensatory mitigation to implement a proactive wetlands restoration effort at the state level, primarily for coastal systems. At that time, the sole measure of success was quantity, or the number of acres preserved or restored, the no net loss in the short-term goal or the gain in the long-term goal. Also at that time, the National Coastal Non-Point Program, which was jointly administered by NOAA and EPA, provided guidance that required states to evaluate the success of wetland protection as related to non-point source pollution abatement. So at this time, some folks at CZM, Coastal Zone Management, namely Bruce Carlisle and Jan Smith, had concerns that the quantity measure of wetland protection was insufficient. Through personal observations of coastal wetland systems, they were able to find that salt marshes and other estuarine habitats were degraded by various anthropogenic sources. This was evidenced by observations of stressed marsh plants and empirical data that marine fishes and coastal birds were in decline. CZM was convinced that changes in land use and other anthropogenic activities were stressing these systems, but methods to accurately demonstrate this in wetlands have not yet been adequately explored. At that time, scientists had already been using biologically based multi-metric approaches to assess the condition of rivers and streams, including the Index of Biotic Integrity, or IBI, first developed by Dr. James Carr at the University of Washington back in 1981. So CZM decided to take a biologically based approach and establish the Wetland Assessment Program. And I will refer to the IBIs quite a bit later in some of the methods that I will be describing here at CZM. At that time, grants were awarded by NOAA and later EPA to research and develop methods for assessing wetland condition. Now, as a coastal zone program, the methods naturally focused on coastal wetlands, particularly salt marshes, bordering riverine wetlands, and isolated depressional wetlands, which are the predominant types in our pilot watershed here for this project. I guess it's also worth mentioning at this time that EPA established a national and regional working group for the biological assessment of wetlands. The BOG, the national group, is now defunct, and there are a number of regional groups throughout the country. At that time, the New England BOG was established. So now that I've set some background information for you, I'm going to move on to slide 88 and lay out some program goals for our wellness assessment program. As previously mentioned, the primary goal of the program at its inception was to develop and evaluate techniques for assessing the ecological integrity of coastal wetlands. Another important goal was to translate the information on integrity or condition into management action, namely identifying impaired wetlands, pre- and post-monitoring of restoration efforts to evaluate success, and inventorying wetlands in localized areas for watershed analysis, which might lead to the implementation of best management practices to address NTS pollution, for example. And finally, to transfer the assessment techniques to interested parties, most directly to New England and Mid-Atlantic states and regional or local NGOs working in similar systems. Early work focused on developing what EPA would now consider a level 3 or tier 3 assessment method described in Michael's presentation as producing quantitative data with no certainty of wetland condition within an assessment area. This CZM method, termed WHAT for Wetland Health Assessment Toolbox, is a multi-metric approach and uses biological, chemical, hydrological, and other physical measurements collected at reference and study sites. It was later developed into a volunteer handbook for monitoring New England salt marshes. Recent work at CZM has focused on developing a rapid assessment method for assessing condition of coastal wetlands in New England. In EPA terms, this would be a level 2 or tier 2 assessment method, also described in Michael's presentation as evaluating the general condition of individual wetlands using relatively simple field indicators. We find that both of these methods utilize landscape assessment techniques to measure human disturbance. Over to slide 89. This is an example that depicts a paired study and reference site in a pilot watershed of Ocoit Bay on Cape Cod in southeastern Massachusetts. The red dot you see on your screen indicates a tidal restriction, in this case a boulder dam. And the lower marsh area was identified as the best attainable reference site and the upper marsh area as the study site. And I'll get into more on reference sites later in this talk. Okay, over to slide 90. We note that to get a condition, these methods attempt to measure key biological responses to human disturbance. Both methods attempt to capture the wide range of disturbances, including stormwater runoff, septage, draining, filling, and others you see on screen. CZM's level 3 method has evolved with each application, but consistent throughout has been the use of the Land Use Index, created in an attempt to quantify human disturbance at a given wetland. It was developed to account for potential NPS pollutant contributions, physical alterations, and other stressors from surrounding land uses and landscape conditions. Really relies on use of land use type coefficients, pervious area estimation, land use and vegetation within a 100-meter buffer zone, and readily identifiable impacts such as storms, storm drains, runoff, and eroding banks. I can't get into too detail for this discussion, given the time, but sort of summarizes our land use index and some of the disturbance indicators that we were using to get at condition in the end. Over to slide 91. This is simply another graphic of a wetland with a 100-meter buffer in a GIS environment. And again, the land use index was applied within that buffer. And you can, in this graphic, you'll see the different land uses occurring in this particular wetland. Over to slide 92. This brings us to some of the key components of our level 3 field-based assessment. I guess really here what we're asking is what do we measure? And based on literature reviews and professional experience, we determined that vegetation, avifauna, macroinvertebrates, and fish are useful indicators in assessing condition of an aquatic system. Sampling of these biota uses a comparative design approach using study and reference sites as earlier described. Great importance at this stage was the development of a Quality Assurance Project Plan, or QAP, which many of you might be familiar with, that ensures that our data is being collected in a sufficient way and for maximal quality. And again, many of you probably know that if you are using federal funding, EPA, NOAA funding for some of these projects, QAP is actually mandatory, but also very helpful. So ultimately, biological data are analyzed in a multi-metric framework generating a quantitative score. Again, continuing now on slide 93. 1993, continuing with our level 3 type methodology. These metrics are derived from measurements of vegetation of avifauna, macroinvertebrates, fish, and some of these actual metrics might include species diversity, species composition, and abundance of rare and pollution-tolerant species. We've already touched that multimetric approaches have been used in wadeable rivers and streams for quite some time, first being developed back in 1981, but never had really been fully explored for use in wetlands until, well, probably within the last 10 years. And again, we also did touch on metrics being scored for reference site and then some to produce a final index score. And again, I will speak briefly again on reference sites later in this presentation. Over to slide 94. Here, all the biological indices for wetland assessment can be combined and integrated into a single cumulative score, which is the wetland ecological condition. We can use this to track degradation over time, track restoration over time, as we talked about pre- and post-monitoring of a restoration site. It's important to note that its quantitative output should be viewed as a general ranking score and should not be and should be used in a proper context. For instance, it may be difficult to make comparisons from one study site to another outside of that reference context. For example, stating that study site X is more impaired than study site Y is only valid when qualified. It would be more appropriate to state that site X exhibits more impairment of its biological or physical components than site Y when compared to the reference domain as established by reference site Z. So it may sound confusing, but and it's definitely a topic to be discussed amongst wetland scientists, what really is a reference condition site. And so here you'll see for this particular study we used what we call regional reference sites and paired reference sites. And again, touch on that a little in a moment. Slide 95 is just a sort of chart of the vegetation index of biotic integrity score, and that's for some select sites. And at the bottom of the screen, there, at the bottom of the chart, you can see the x-axis an R, a dash R, and a dash S, and that just simply refers to the reference site and the study site. And here we can clearly see that the vegetation IBI scores are clearly higher in the reference site than they are in the study site, which would make sense. So, on to slide 96. It's a scatter plot of some data for this level 3 pilot project. Here we have two types of reference sites, which I briefly mentioned a moment ago. Those regional reference sites, which you can see based on this scatter plot of wetland ecological condition and land use index, are really at the top tier there and score really well in what we would classify as the most pristine wetland we have within that particular region. Relatively low land use impacts and the like. Then we have the paired reference and study site, indicated by green and red, respectively. And overall, I guess you can see that in this particular pilot, the indicators we were using did correlate, fit fairly well with the land use index, the disturbance index. So I'd like to go on to slide 97 now. And here you're looking at the same scatter plot, but here we have a sort of a expected range of restoration potential kind of windowed out. And I guess this really does explain a little more what the difference between that reference site there in green, as that green dot, versus the reference site in those blue dots really gets at. We have this site in red here that should not be expected to actually get to the condition of those reference regional sites that in blue, and with this we just see what the best attainable restoration potential is for that particular site. Okay, on to slide 98. I'm moving quickly here, but I don't have a good introduction slide here, but what I'm I'm going to begin talking about now is our, what I was talking about is our level 2 rapid assessment method, again, that Michael Skoltafava had mentioned as part of this tiered, this three-tiered approach that EPA has been really selling. And so what we decided to do was to take a lot of the information that we had learned based on our level 3 type assessments and develop a rapid assessment methodology where we can apply these at a great sort of landscape level scale. And to do that, we got together with a group of people, got some help from US EPA Narragansett Lab, some of their Office of Research and Development Labs, and some others at some in academia, and came up with a list of indicators that we felt were useful in describing condition and disturbance within wetlands, coastal wetlands. And so this project begins with, or this exercise begins with sort of a office-based GIS exercise, and really it's using, it's developing our wetland population and then selecting based on stratified random sampling, particular sites that we are going to actually sample out in the field. And we did use EMAP, EPA's EMAP protocol for stratified sampling. And so there we went into our list of indicators, and which we have classified as characterization, condition, and disturbance. And slide 98 lists the characterization indicators that we capture for each wetland site. The ones that you see on screen here are a sample of those indicators, and they are captured in the office using GIS environment, orthophotography, and whatnot, and really just, again, characterize the particular wetland that we're looking at. And for this, we don't actually have a quantitative output that rolls into a cumulative index score, but this helps us identify with the wetland and can later be used to do further data analysis by breaking out separate classifications of wetland based on landscape position, based on the type of wetland it is, and whatnot. On to slide 99, getting into our disturbance indicators. And these you see here are semi-quantitative, I would say. We have to score them using an ordinal scale system. And again, keeping in mind that this is a rapid assessment method. So I should have probably mentioned earlier that being a rapid assessment method means that the office and field-based efforts should not really go beyond half a day in the field for each of these to really be able to assess these marshes out in such great numbers. And so these are therefore semi-quantitative, and I won't go through the list here, but you can probably see a number of repeats from our level 3 type method. On to slide 100, getting into the condition indicators. With these are all field-based indicators, and when we do go out into the field, this rapid assessment method does involve vegetation transects, getting at species abundance. It involves quantifying abundance and distribution of plant communities. There are some soil indicators that get at plant fragments and bearing capacity, and that, which is sort of the compaction of the marsh. What is the understory of the marsh like? Is there a lot of peat? Is there not? Is it very sandy? And, of course, invasive plants. Here in Massachusetts, we have, as many do, we have issues with Phragmites australis, common reed. And so we definitely want to capture that in our condition indicators. On slide 101, this is just a snapshot of actually the introductory page of our sort of operational draft rapid assessment method. And the graphic you see in the center there, that photograph, is just some of the GIS work that helps us set up for the field-based assessment. You can see a number of points laid out there. Those have been randomly selected within that marsh. From there, we set buffers at certain distances to capture different types of indicators, to measure different types of indicators. And we also have, you also see, a land use buffer surrounding that to capture and calculate land use for land use index, which eventually all this will get rolled into a cumulative score. And I apologize for running through this so quickly, but I know I don't have too much time to spend on the details of the assessment methods, but I will sort of direct you to some publications that will better explain where and what we have done with this. So on to slide 102, we talked about disturbance and condition indicators earlier, and from those indicators we have developed actual metrics. These are more of the quantitative metrics that we can pull from and actually get at our condition scores. So we're not really creating scores, a cumulative score from our indicators, but from our metrics. And if this seems a little unclear to people, for instance, I guess I can explain it as such that the indicators, for instance, plant communities, I might pull a number of data from plant community indicator measurements to create separate metrics. I might look at the percent of a particular plant species within a marsh. I might look at the distribution of that plant species within a marsh. So, indicator to metric to final score. And so, 102, slide 102 shows the disturbance metrics that we've calculated, and this is just a sampling of those as well. On to slide 103, just going to talk about the condition metrics, and I touched on sort of abundance, percent abundance of particular species within a marsh, and of course, here we are with condition metrics, and that's where we're coming there. On to slide 104, here's just a scatter plot of some of the data we've collected for the 2004-2005 season, which was the sort of developmental phase of this rapid assessment method. And we're still in the sort of data analysis phase, but this scatter plot and regression analysis here indicates that we have some work to do, but we have an R-square here of 0.39, and looking at condition and disturbance, we can see some correlation. We need to perhaps tweak our metrics a little, and we will be reconvening our group to go ahead and look at these and test some of these out in the field, some new ideas that have coming in the field, use some existing data that have been collected by some of our neighboring partners here in Rhode Island at US EPA and Narragansett Lab, and also maybe using some of our Level 3 data collected prior to 2004 to help calibrate our rapid assessment method metrics. So with that, I would like to open it up for questions. I will say again that if I piqued your interest at all or if confused your understanding of wetlands assessment in Massachusetts at all, I do encourage you to read the three wetland assessment reports, which focus on level 3 assessments that are available on our website at mass.gov/CZM. Our level 2 method, the New England Rapid Assessment Method, is currently in operational draft form, but a comprehensive manual will be published next summer. So stay tuned for that. And again, on our website, you can definitely find some more information about what we've done. And I encourage you to also look at what some other states are doing. Maybe moving quite well. So thank you again, and again, questions.
Thank you very much, Mark. We will again have time for questions. If you move to slide 105 with me, you'll see all of our speakers. However, I first want to draw your attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. You will be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speaker's email addresses and phone numbers. If you go ahead to 106, on the left-hand sidebar is the links button, which has additional resources identified for today's webcast, in case you're interested. And also on that left-hand sidebar is the feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do consider your comments in our quest to improve our webcast. Before we move on to questions, Michael Scazzafava would like to say a few words.
Thanks, Megan. I just wanted to get back to trying to save face on that estuarine versus clustering question. I was hoping Mark would help me out there, but we went and did a little research during while Mark was talking, and an estuarine wetland in the cordon system is defined as a deep water tidal habitats and adjacent tidal wetlands that are usually semi-enclosed by land but have open, partially obstructed, or sporadic access to the ocean. A palustrine wetland includes all nine tidal wetlands dominated by trees, shrubs, persistent emergent mosses or lichens, and have all such tidal wetlands where ocean-derived salinities are less than or below 0.5 parts per thousand. So.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, and on to our questions submitted online. Our first question is for Mark, from Jeremy in Virginia. What was your pixel size for GIS analysis of the land use index?
Well, fortunately in Massachusetts, we are fortunate enough, I should say, to have 1 to 5,000 half-meter pixel orthographic photos as recently as 2005. And so that's what our land use is classification is based on. That said, actually, that land use was based on 2001, but we're not using Landsat or any national land cover data set for this particular, given the size of our wetlands. I think it's appropriate that we use the best available, as would anyone. So, fortunately, again, in our state, we do have that that mapping. And so I encourage, those that may not have those resources to perhaps run some pilot studies and try actually doing some language classification themselves on a small scale and for wetlands, at least within a buffer, not necessarily a statewide effort, but within a wetland buffer, and seeing what kind of results you can get there.
Thank you, Mark. Our second question is actually for Carrie. So, Carrie, you're going to have to unmute yourself again. The question comes from Karen in Oklahoma, and she asks, how much is the oil and gas industry involved with the Barataria-Terrebonne Management Conference?
We do have them represented on our management conference. We actually have received some corporate funding from several petroleum companies, but in the 100,000 area, 200,000, that's relatively small amounts of funding, but they are among our largest contributors outside of our federal grants and state grants.
Thank you, Kerry. At this time, I'm going to open the phone lines, so if you do have a question, please state your name and where you're from, and then ask us your question, and please speak up. Are there any questions from the phones? Okay, if there are no questions from the phone, this does conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I would like to thank Nancy Larson, Daryl Brown, Elizabeth Riley, Carrie St. Pei, Shelley Sparks, Michael Scazzafava, Jan Smith, and Mark Carullo for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us, and we hope you can join us next week. This is Megan Classic from the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.